We'll now begin our plenary session. We have three speakers this morning, the first of whom is Jerry Szymanski. He's the Reserves and Digital Services Librarian at the Sibley Music Library. He's also an adjunct instructor in musicology at Eastman. He received his Bachelor of Music in Music Theory and Composition from Houghton College, just down the road, and a Master of Library Science from the University at Buffalo. His interest in Jenny Lind and her visit to Rochester was piqued while doing research for Summer Longings, which was a dramatic period film he wrote and directed in 2006, and which was shown at both the George Eastman House and the Little Theater, which is our independent theater down on East Avenue. Since then, he has presented about the Swedish Nightingale in music courses at Eastman and at the Society for American Music, the Music Library Association Joint National Meeting, the MLA Chapter Meeting, and the Rochester Historical Society, and also at the Susan B. Anthony House. His research culminated with a gala historic recreation concert at Incarnate Word Lutheran Church in May of 2011, and he performed as accompanist in Jenny Lind's induction into the Rochester Music Hall of Fame, which just took place a few weeks ago. He's also an avid shutterbug, receiving City Newspaper's Award for Best Local Photographer for both 2010 and 2011. He's exhibited in four solo photography shows, and his print work includes Downbeat and Country Living magazines. So Jerry's going to tell us a little bit about the history of early history of Rochester, as well as the its importance as a cultural center in Western New York. Jerry.
Thanks very much, everybody. I'd like to preface my remarks today by saying that I found that people have been chronicling Rochester's music history right from the get-go. The earliest long-form history of music in Rochester I found was from 1909 by a gentleman named Richard Lansing, and I'm also drawing on some work done by Ernestine Klinzing and also a longtime professor of music at Eastman, Vincent Lenti. Rochester in the mid-19th century was no backwater. It was a bustling boomtown. It was actually America's first boomtown, and it was called the Young Line of the West. This image that you see here of downtown Rochester, a bird's eye view, shows you why. I think I can get the laser pointer to work here, maybe. This right here is the Erie Canal, and it is crossing the Genesee River, right over here, actually. And this is really what made our town the amazing cultural, financial, economic center, really, of New York State, outside of New York City. And it started with the completion of the Erie Canal, which some of you from the area probably know from that song you learned in sixth grade about the mule and all that. And this was the connection between the Hudson River and the Great Lakes, which of course led to navigation all the way from the Atlantic Ocean into the Great Lakes. And it was this amazing engineering feat that allowed Rochester, with its power of the river, to harness the industrial revolution that was occurring really all around the world. And as you can see from this very early engraving of Main Street, there were factories like crazy. And it was the power of the waterfalls and the gorge and Brown's Ray sending water through the mills over wheels that were grinding flour that led to Rochester being known as the Flour City. Here's an early mill. And this, we're talking like 1810, 1820, that sort of thing. We were known as the Flour City. And as you can see from this image right here, this is a house over in the Cornhill neighborhood that, in addition to the rough and tumble canal folks and the folks working in the mills, there were people that were becoming quite wealthy, the middle class, the upper class, the folks that were managing business on the canal and at the mills. And these were folks that were living, a wonderful lifestyle. And they were cultured people that were interested in music. As early as 1817, there was a band formed here in Rochester. This is way before the incorporation as a city in 1834. Well, our founding father, a lot of folks think that we're named after Rochester, England. We're actually named after a guy, Nathaniel Rochester. You can see a portrait of him done by John James Audubon at our art gallery. He, you know, founded our city. He bought the land. He got people to move here. It was called Rochesterville for a while, you know, like Hollywood Land. They decided to cut that end off. And he actually played in the very first band. He played clarinet. So right from the get-go, our founding father was a musician. The folks that were living in houses like this, though, they were dealing more with sort of parlor music. And I'd like to read you a little bit of a clip here of an announcement. A moral concert at the Morton House in 1844. Music by Miss Clara Jane, violinist, and Miss Emma Lorraine, violoncellist, accompanied by their voices. Nothing in song, word, or dress can be objectionable to the visits of the most fastidious of any religious denomination. And I bring this point because way back then, even though our founding father was part of this, and even though there were band concerts where they would play 26 pieces plus encores, the idea of music was still considered, especially secular music, was considered objectionable. In 1828, there was a benefit concert at a theater, and the proceeds were given to the Female Charitable Society. And those proceeds were rejected because music was deemed demoralizing, and the theater was deemed demoralizing. We'll hear more about the Female Charitable Society later. But it was amazing. All through the 1840s, the newspapers did not list any sort of concerts, any kind of entertainments were not listed in the paper. You would have to sort of hear about it by word of mouth or handbills because it was all thought of as sort of being, you know, uncouth. One of the first places in town where music was made outside of the churches was the Eagle Tavern or Eagle Hotel. And this is literally a block away from here. This is where the Powers Building now sits. This was thought of as being the best place in town, and it's unfortunate that it's no longer with us. The building that's there has been there since 1860, so it's kind of amazing that we have these two historic structures, but it was a pretty cool place. Its rival, sort of in looks and also in a center of music for early Rochester, was the National Hotel. And lots of music took place at these places, including one of the earliest traveling musician groups, the Swiss Bell Ringers. In this engraving, you see it's both men and women. In this picture, it's all gents ringing away. And here we have the ladies with their, yes. They came in the 1840s, which is pretty cool. Also in the 1840s, this gentleman, who many of you may know just from his image, Lowell Mason, came over from Boston and started these musical conventions. They were week-long workshops at the First Presbyterian Church. And the first one was so popular in 1840 that he came back in 1843, and in 1848, and in 1850. And to actually have someone from another town come and do, you know, like a little conference about music in the 1840s in a place like Rochester is pretty amazing. We all know Mason for his wonderful music education. SUNY Fredonia has Mason Hall, and of course, he's the guy who gave us Joy to the World. And here is an image of First Presbyterian Church, long gone, unfortunately, but it was quite a musical center. In fact, it brought this gentleman, Henry Russell, who had amazing hair. He came to us from England and was an organist and musician. He probably was the first professional musician to stay in Rochester for a little while. Some of you may know his tune. Tim was singing it earlier, so I'm going to attempt this now. Cheer, boys, cheer. Bum, 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 bum. William Bulkham recorded an album of Henry Russell songs with a singer a few years ago on the Nonesuch label. And he actually stayed in Rochester for quite a few years and was really sort of like the first professional guy that we had here in our town. And he left, but that's okay. He stayed for a little while. And then we started to get people of stature who came to Rochester to perform. And this is Ole Bull, the Norwegian violinist. And he performed here in Rochester back in 1844. And a lot of folks think of that as the start of this parade of musicians that have come through our town. Christie's Minstrels came through and performed at the Eagle Tavern in 1845. And there were quite a few other minstrel shows that came through Rochester. The people that were doing tours were starting to see Rochester as a destination, as a good place to show up. We had this gentleman, Leopold de Meyer. This is an older picture of him, carte de visite, it looks like, but when he came in the 1840s, he was a bit of a younger man. And this guy, who also had great hair, Henri Hertz, from France, also came. The city fathers were realizing that it wasn't enough to have a little space above the rooms in the hotel. It really needed to have a nice concert hall. And so they got together, and through the auspices of this gentleman, Abelard Reynolds, who had created the Reynolds Arcade, the original Reynolds Arcade, and his son, William Reynolds, who looks like his father, I guess. It's like, you know, some of these pictures, it's like, you know, it'd be great to find a picture of this person looking younger, like the sun. So here's downtown Rochester, and we're right over here, and right there, on this side of the river, right next to the river, and right here, right there, is where the Reynolds Arcade was built. And right behind it, they built this new concert hall. Here is an engraving of Reynolds Arcade, and this is the old downtown Four Corners. And there's the Eagle Hotel on the left. This was built by the Rochester Athenaeum and Mechanics Association. It was called Corinthian Hall, or the Athenaeum Building. And that's because inside there were some columns that had the Corinthian tops on them. It was built in 1849. Paid for by Mr. Reynolds, but kind of sponsored by the whole association. Here's an interior shot. It was where this group of city fathers and scholars met, and it was quite an amazing place. You can see from this image, it was fairly palatial. You know, I'm sure this is slightly exaggerated, but there's a festival there in Corinthian Hall. And of course, the first person to really give it the push was the Swedish Nightingale, Jenny Lind. And there she is right there in the famous painting by Magnus. She was brought here under the auspices of Phineas T. Barnum in 1850. And his press getting her out there into American psyche was amazing. She gave her debut at the Castle Garden in New York City, September 11th. And here's an engraving by Currier and Ives showing all the folks. And there she is on the stage. And here is, I love this picture, this adulation of all these folks rushing towards her and this cherub bringing down this wreath on her. I mean, there's almost no way to describe it short of saying it was kind of like the Beatles arriving. I mean, there were all these screaming girls, you know, at the airport when the Beatles arrived. Well, when Jenny Lind arrived from Liverpool on a steamer in 1850, there were 30 to 40,000 people waiting for her at the harbor to cheer her on. And she walked down this, like, pathway that was laden with flowers. And it was quite the amazing thing. Now, she was an opera singer in her own right. She performed in London at Covent Garden. She was friends with Queen Victoria. She was friends with Mendelssohn. He wrote an aria in Elijah for her. So she was a good singer. She was no slouch. But when she came to the States, people complained that it was really the marketing. You know, it was Barnum's promotion of her that was really the thing that was driving this. We had really Jenny Lind mania. Here's a coin that has her picture on it that I guess you could use for legal tender somewhere. Let me go back a screen. There was the Jenny Lind bed. There was the Jenny Lind locomotive. There's a bottle with her face on it. And then, of course, thousands of pieces of sheet music with her image on it. There's the Jenny Lind polka, which folk musicians still play. So she arrived here in July of 1851. She was met at the train station by the mayor and taken to the Eagle Hotel sort of secretly. The city newspapers describing a furor, which no one uses in the headline anymore. So the furor for this was the fact that the tickets for the first concert were entirely sold out. It says here, hundreds were disappointed in securing tickets. Here we have one of the programs that actually is held at the Sibley Music Library. And it's just a Fontapalooza. It's really quite an amazing... Let me go back to that. Yeah, look at all those fonts. you know, every line something different. So, and these were program books that you could purchase, of course, at the concert. Her concert, her first concert, was literally, I mean, people, it was like a mob. They talk about, you know, just this craziness of people, and it was July, and they described that people were passing out and had to be carried away. Some people were robbed. They were, you know, their contents of their purses were removed, and they were sweating so much that it was like washing day. I'm like, okay. So you also notice that here we have this first thing is a piece for clarinets. The concerts that she performed were not, you know, 2 hours of Jenny Lind singing. They were very carefully paced out with other people performing, either singing duets. There were piano pieces by de Meyer, by Liszt. And here we have, you know, Signor Belletti playing the clarionet. And she sang a variety of operatic arias, some selections from the Messiah, and folk songs, some Swedish. And here we have her singing Coming Through the Rye. She stayed at the Eagle Hotel, and while she was here, she had her daguerreotype taken just a few doors away at the Reynolds Arcade. Unfortunately, that is lost. So she decided, because so many people were disappointed with the fact that they weren't able to get a ticket the first time for that concert, to give a second concert, which is really unheard of on her entire tour. And she came up with the idea that instead of just having people rushing the window of the ticket booth and buying tickets en masse and then maybe scalping them, that they would actually auction the tickets off. And all of the proceeds ended up going to the Female Charitable Society, which by 1851 was very happy to receive her gift of $800, which in 1851 money is a lot of money. I've looked at their ledgers. That year they had $30.53. And it was like, Jenny Lind gift, and it underlined three times. So here she is giving another concert. And it was to the point where the folks at Corinthian Hall were just like overjoyed about the fact that she selected Corinthian Hall as, pronounced by her, all requisites for a music hall, the best she had seen in America until that point. Also, that week, we had Madame Anna Bishop. I don't know if any of you know who she is, but she was sort of the anti-Jenny Lind. She was a marked woman. She had run away from her husband, Sir Henry Rowley Bishop, with an Italian harpist, Signor Boscia. So if you're a harpist, you know that name. And she was giving tours as well. And her shtick was the fact that she was giving a tour in costume. She would perform scenes from operas. Henry Rowley Bishop, of course, everyone might not know his name, but you know his song. He wrote Home Sweet Home. And in a strange twist of fate, Home Sweet Home, the manuscript for the opera Clary or the Maid of Milan, where Home Sweet Home comes from, is now at the Sibley Music Library. It was originally a four-part chorus, as you can see from this, but it was sort of structured as a solo song in the 1840s. There's a picture of him, and there is the sheet music for Home Sweet Home. It became the most popular song of the 19th century. And so we have sort of Jenny's rival coming to Rochester. Here's Signor Boscia as well. And this is her positively last lyric entertainment. And she's doing all sorts of stuff like from Rossini, lots of bel canto. Here's a bit of the program for Jenny Lind's second and last concert. They had to hastily put this together. You know, she had this range of repertoire that she would do, so they kind of got this going here. And you can see, again, it's this sort of potpourri of stuff, which so many concerts, just in general, in the States back in the 1840s and 50s, were these potpourris. You know, even if it was an orchestra concert, there'd be, you know, somebody coming out and giving a reading. So here we have Bohemian Girl favorite themes on the clarinet, and then here's Signor Belletti singing this song from La Sonnambula, and then an Obbligato by Joseph Burke, and then finally she's, you know, finally coming out and doing something. But it was a huge success. There's so much sort of left over in our town because of her visit, including this beautiful engraving that's at the Sibley Library, this Parian bust that's at the Rochester Historical Society. And then she, in addition to giving money to the Female Charitable Society, paid for the casting of a bell at this this former Lutheran church, this church built in the 1820s, Zion Lutheran Church, which is now apartments and condos for Eastman students called Halo Lofts. I guess the halo part is a nod to its religious start there. This was merged with another Lutheran church back in the 1960s, and the bell, the Jenny Lind Bell, is the only bell in that tower. Right over there on East Avenue at the corner of Goodman Street. And that's why we did our recreation concert there at that church. It had great acoustics. You know, everyone was happy to help out with that there at the church. And they actually have the Jenny Lind Bell in their tower, which is kind of a cool thing. Also, that same week, we got these guys coming in here. This is the Hutchison Family Singers. That was a crazy week in July of 1851, but it just kind of shows you that there was this continuous stream of performers that were coming in. Dan Rice was here with his circus that week, too. And the Hutchison Family of Singers from New Hampshire, but they traveled all over the place. They were for women's rights, temperance, and abolition. And they were great friends with Frederick Douglass. They also wrote a welcome song for Jenny Lind, and the words were by Jesse. And you know, if you didn't know who Jesse Hutchison was, you were lost there. They were great friends with Frederick Douglass, who then spoke at Corinthian Hall. Susan B. Anthony spoke at Corinthian Hall. Charles Dickens spoke at Corinthian Hall, as well as Ralph Waldo Emerson. P.T. Barnum came back for a second lecture. Sojourner Truth spoke there. There were all these things dealing with the Mechanics Institute. Here's this demonstration of electricity. The Mechanics Institute is what we now know as the Rochester Institute of Technology. And this is from their page. And you can see right from the beginning, concert by Jenny Lind at Corinthian Hall. Henry Ward Beecher speaks at Corinthian Hall. The Mechanics Institute and Association became the foundation of this great technical school that a lot of you, how many of you went to the tour yesterday? You know, who would think that there'd be some sort of musical connection between that giant campus with all this incredible technology and, you know, the Swedish Nightingale? Go figure. After she left, there were tons of concerts, including concerts by a little orchestra. Here's Henry Schenck, who was a former student of Böhm, you know, the guy who invented the keys on the flute, Theobald Böhm. And you can see from this particular image that, again, it was sort of a potpourri of stuff. I know it's kind of small type, but there's music here by people that you know, like Mozart and Bellini, and people that you may not know, like Drouet and Lochner and Betzmeyer, and of course, maybe a piece by Böhm, his teacher, as well as Kaliwada. And I love how it says here at the bottom, an accomplished lady performer will preside at the piano. Yeah. We saw the return of Ole Bull and Adelina Patti. Quite a few concerts at the time were put together by this gentleman named Maurice Strakach, who saw that Rochester was a gold mine for the traveling and touring musician. And he was another impresario, but had a whole stable of stars that he was sending all across the United States, and was sending quite a few of them here, including this lady, Teresa Parodi, who also came to Rochester as a soprano singer. And now we're starting to move into the era of the Flower City. You know, the folks at Ellwanger and Berry were starting their nurseries in the 1830s, and by the 1850s and 60s, Rochester had moved away from doing the flour milling as people were really moving out west, out to Michigan, Illinois, Indiana, you know, Minnesota. That's where the flour was going. And so we suddenly started to see all these folks doing horticultural stuff. This is the remnants of the Ellwanger Berry Gardens. And there's a whole neighborhood in town that's named after them that used to be where their nurseries were. Not to put a fine point on that, but they're saying that this has 300 blooms on one shoot, which, let me step backwards and fall off. I don't know how if that really worked, but go figure. Here we have another rival nursery here in town, James Vick's Nursery. And there's there was a racetrack in town called Vick Park over by Park Avenue. There's still a curve in the road that runs along the path of the racetrack. And you know, when you live in a town where they tell you that a pea pod is like a sword, you know, it's a pretty cool thing. This era in the 1850s, in the 1860s, it was dominated by this gentleman right here, Henri Appy. And there's a connection with Jenny Lind as well. He actually came over as part of her retinue and loved Rochester so much that he actually came back to Rochester to live, and was, after Mr. Russell, probably the first professional outside musician to make his home here. And here he started the first orchestra, Rochester's Philharmonic Society. This is here organized in 1865. And this program that you see right here kind of shows you the kinds of things that you would have heard. Music of Haydn, music of Herzog, Harold Zampa Overture, and music of Johann Strauss, as well as a quartet and a reading of Sheridan's Ride. We had Mr. Talberg come to Rochester, the rival of Liszt. This is Christina Nilsson, the famous soprano from Sweden, who followed Jenny Lind. Sarasate and Vietomp also came to Rochester. Adelina Patti came back as an older person. I mean, when she was out there singing, she was like a child prodigy. She was like 9 years old. And Louis Moreau Gottschalk. And I'd like to, give me 1 second, I'd like to talk about this. He loved coming to Rochester and kind of felt that it was really worth his while to come here. He described Rochester as charming town, one of the neatest, most animated, and most civilized of the West. My concerts here are always profitable, and my audiences always well-disposed. And now I'd like to tell you about some gentlemen who came here with their families. They grew up here in Rochester. In the mid to late 1800s, we started to see a huge influx of German immigrants, and the Dossenbach family were the folks that arrived. And there were two of them. This is Theodore, who became a bandmaster and for 20 years conducted the Park Band. And then I have been unable to find a photograph of Hermann Dossenbach, but that's this gentleman here is the conductor of this orchestra. And as you can see, it's pretty sizable. Hermann Dossenbach and Henri Appy have a connection because the Dossenbachs were in Rochester and they were also in Niagara Falls for a bit. And Henri Appy was in Niagara Falls and he was walking down the street near the suspension bridge and he heard someone playing the violin in the second floor window and he knocked on the door and said, "Who's that? You know, if you come to Rochester, I'll pay for your lessons." And it created this whole amazing thing where Dossenbach actually studied in Rochester. He ended up going to Europe and studying in Europe over there. His trip was paid for by folks like George Eastman and Rush Rees, the president of the University of Rochester, and the Sibley Watson family. And he came back and got this orchestra together. And it was around until pretty much the founding of the Eastman School as the main orchestra here in town. They performed at this Lyceum Theater, which was torn down in the 1930s. As a rival orchestra, believe it or not, we had two orchestras. We had the son of Henry Schenck, Ludwig Schenck, who was conducting an orchestra at the Convention Hall. And this is, for those of you in the area, this is where Jiva Theater is right now. And this was an interesting building that was an armory for a while, and then it was the Convention Hall that had 4,000 seats, and then it was the armory again, and now it's our professional regional theater is in this particular space. So there were actually two orchestras going at the same time. Hermann Dossenbach, the conductor of this orchestra, his dedication to Rochester and its music and sort of elevating it to a really high level cannot be underestimated. They had a sort of a tribute concert to him in which all the musicians played for free back in the 1940s at Highland Bowl. That's in Highland Park where the Lilac Festival is right now. And it was attended by thousands of people who were touched by this conductor and this teacher. Here's a picture of Rush Rees. He was a huge supporter of music after he was convinced by George Eastman that it would be a good thing to have a music school at the university. And also the Rush Rees Library is named after him at the main university campus. I must also mention this gentleman, David Hochstein. He was also a talented young violinist, and in one of those sort of freak, history repeating itself, Hermann Dossenbach, was approached by Mrs. Sibley Watson, who said, "I heard this kid practicing. you should hear him. And he was also someone that the community rallied behind, and they sent him to Europe for training and for lessons. And he was unfortunately killed in World War I. And he was such a huge talent that the community just sort of mourned together. And you can see this is actually from the memorial concert. And this is in the space that could hold 4,000 people. And the Hochstein Memorial Music School is actually in the Memorial Hall, are named after him. This is a Presbyterian church that merged with another church and for a while sat vacant, and the Hochstein School has moved into the space. In this space is where they held Susan B. Anthony's funeral. So it's a nice space. It's a great performance hall, and quite a few concerts are held there all the time now. So we're starting to move into the 20th century, and we're still getting not only all these folks that are homegrown, but we're getting folks from sort of the golden age of the Metropolitan Opera, all these sort of folks that you would get on a cylinder now. Alma Gluck, Leopold Godowsky, Carl Flesch, Joseph Hoffman, Fritz Kreisler, Gabrilowitsch, the great Irish tenor John McCormick. Walter Damrosch brought his New York orchestra here. Gustav Mahler brought his orchestra here, his New York orchestra. Emma, Ephraim, Ernestine, Calvé, Zimblist, and Schenk, Schumann Heinck, respectively, all came here, and Paderewski. Here he is actually in Rochester, accepting some sort of an award. Paderewski, the very first person to sign the Eastman School of Music guest book. Here is a young George Eastman, and this is this guy, and here's an old George Eastman. This guy was listening to all this music as he was growing up in Rochester. All these, you know, orchestras and bands and all these performers that were coming into town. Here he is more around the time of the school. And then here, you know, is an image of our school. To cram all this into such a short amount of time, but to show you that Rochester was developing as this musical city because we were lucky enough to have, right from the get-go, people that were interested in making music and people that were interested in listening to music that was coming from the outside. And boy, did we have music coming from the outside. It was an amazing thing. And, you know, very shortly after the formation of the school, we were sending people out into the world and being ambassadors for music as well. So I thank you very much. I know that leaves you sort of hanging at the start of the school, but I wanted you to sort of see how Rochester sort of formed as this musical place that led to all sorts of wonderful things. So thanks very much.